We want to help people be more connected with their local environment. You know, and if you've got a garden and you can make it beautiful, then that's wonderful. And if you can make it beautiful for you, but also for the native pollinators, then that's wonderful. And I think the inspiration that so many people get from visiting Chelsea Flower Show, where you've got these innovative ideas, and although it's very controversial with some of the gardens, some of the top garden influencers are saying these are not gardens, it's a wild area, but actually who's to say you can't have your back garden as a habitat for beavers or as a habitat for particular birds? You know, why does a garden have to be formal? It can be anything you want. It's your natural retreat, it's your place to go to heal, and nature heals. So the more natural we can have gardens, the better for everybody.
Hello, lovely people, and welcome to another episode of The Wellness Way. And today I have beekeeper extraordinaire, friend of the show, wonderful all-round human being, Paula Carnell. Now, if you haven't listened to my first podcast with Paula, please go and check that out. We talk about her illness with Ehlers-Danlos and her recovery, more importantly, and how she did this naturally and how that was edited from her TED Talk, which if you haven't seen her TED Talk, go and check that out as well. Paula, welcome back to The Wellness Way. Thank you for being here. And this time we're in the studio, which is fantastic to have you here.
Oh, it's just such a joy. And we've had such a lovely time together already, and yeah, it's wonderful to be in your studio, and I'm just in awe. What I'd do to have a studio like this. Amazing.
Thank you. Right, there is so much to uncover today and talk about, because we didn't really talk that much about beekeeping last time you were here. And everybody, I think, is very well aware that our bees are in decline, and we're going to have a conversation later as to when, if our bees die, do we die? Because I know you have some very interesting thoughts on that. But let's just start off, because, you know, we're at the beginning of 2024, and in December 2023, the EU Parliament decided to renew licenses for Roundup and glyphosate and all of those pesticides that we know are hurting our planet and killing our bees. But the UK government has just done an emergency ruling on nicotinoids, haven't they? And it's for sugar beet that they've done it for the farmers, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And they did this last year and I believe the year before. So neonicotinoids were banned by the EU possibly 8 to 12 years ago, and so they haven't been used. And neonicotinoids are a different type of insecticide, and they're actually made up of five ingredients. So you'll have three neonicotinoids, which are genetically modified synthetic substances that contain the nicotine gene in them. And so the nicotine gene makes them addictive, like nicotine. So when insects forage on a plant that has the nicotine gene in, they keep coming back, even though it's poisonous for them, just like humans.
Yep.
So you have the three neonicotinoids added with two fungicides. Now, they combine them together and make them into a coating for plants, for seeds, so that they can sow the seeds. And the plants are then glyphosate or Roundup ready, which means that when you spray a whole crop with Roundup, it will only kill the weeds, it won't kill the plants. So these seeds, as they grow, it's called a systemic pesticide. So as the plant grows, every part of that plant is toxic. And it carries through to the leaves. So if a bird drinks a drop of water off the leaf, if a bee drinks the nectar, if it has the pollen, whatever they have, it's toxic. Now, you have a 94% runoff from these seed coatings into the soil around. So what has been really damaging is when a farmer might have a coated seed. So they started off using sunflower seeds, and you'd have a field of sunflowers, and then perhaps you'd have wildflowers around the outside. You'd get the runoff of the neonicotinoids would go into the wildflower seeds, so it's then making the whole area toxic. And we still don't know how long the residues of these chemicals stay in the soil. There's Professor Dave Goulson, who is an amazing bee researcher, a bee biologist in the UK. And he's been studying the effects of these kind of chemicals on bees, but not just honeybees, on bumblebees as well, because the bumblebees often nest underground. They're under the soil, under the lawns, and they're quite often the first species of bees that are hit by these chemicals.
Sorry to interrupt this podcast. The Wellness Way has got a brand new interactive ebook out. I've created a beginner's guide to your natural health systems to help you navigate through the jungle of natural health. A banquet of knowledge wrapped up in a simple ebook, featuring some of my top guests from the podcast. As an added bonus, I've even thrown in my meditation album, The Wellness Awakening, From Past Lives to Passing. Head over to my webpage, phillyjlay.com, to grab your copy now. And while you're there, why don't you sign up for my newsletter? And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share this podcast so we can continue to get this information out. Remember, the doctor of your future is you.
Well, as the pesticides, as the rain comes in and the pesticides soak into the soil, then they're going to be hit, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. Now, what most people don't realise is you have what's called the LD50, which is a measurement that can then label a product bee-friendly. And what the LD50 is they will take one of the ingredients of the five ingredients of a neonicotinoid, and they will drop it onto, using a dropper, onto a bee in a petri dish. When 50% of the bees survive from this practice, they can then call the product LD50. It's past the LD50. Therefore, it's safe for bees.
Wow.
Yeah.
50%.
And they never test all the ingredients together.
Together.
They only test them one at a time. And Rachel Carson, the wonderful biologist from the 1950s and 60s, she did all the research on DDT, and she proved that when you have chemicals, when you actually combine them, the combined strength is far worse than the individual chemical.
This is the same with all chemicals, because there are over 85,000 chemicals that are licensed for use worldwide. Mm. And not one of those chemicals has been tested together.
No.
And we don't know the side effects of this. But I think, you know, this, and I think it's a scandal. I mean, I think it is an absolute scandal. We'll wake people up to agricultural farming more than anything else, because I think bees is something that we all relate to. And you know, we'll talk about the healing power of bees later. But it is, you know, everybody, when you start seeing those bees die, And noticing that they're just not out there. I mean, I remember last year I spoke to you, you were at Chelsea Flower Show, and you'd done a wonderful, worked on a wonderful bee garden at Chelsea. And I remember talking to you the night before, and you said, you know, I'm walking around the flower show. You know, it wasn't open to the public. You're just having a look. And you said, there are no bees here.
Mm. Yeah, it was really interesting. I was there with the Newt, who sponsored the flower show. And for anyone who doesn't know what the Chelsea Flower Show is, it's this incredible garden show where you have garden designers will design gardens and they're for competition. And it's been very controversial in the last couple of years because more garden designers are doing more natural gardens. So there's a lot more weeds, you know,
yes,
sort of the dandelions and the nettles. They're all appearing in the gardens in a much more natural planting style rather than the sort of Britain and Bloom, you know, clipped lawns and sort of rubbery looking flowers. So it should be attracting more pollinators. And there are pollinators there. But what really shocked me was the day before Chelsea Flower Show opened, I was actually in a park over the river, so Battersea Park, and I was sat in there, and it's the end of May, and the holly tree was flowering. So holly has tiny little white flowers, which are brilliant for bees. I mean, you won't get the berries if you don't have the bees pollinating holly. And I was sat for about an hour and a half in the garden. I just thought, I need to ground, I need to be sort of all calm, ready for a very busy week at Chelsea. And I was underneath this holly tree. Now, I have a holly tree in my garden, and when it's in bloom, you can hear the buzz of that tree from 20 foot away. I sat underneath this holly tree. There was also some other plants, you know, there were some flowering shrubs and things in the flowering beds. And in an hour and a half, I saw two bumblebees and one honeybee. And that's in May. And that's the peak season for all bees. There should have been numerous different species of carder bees, bumblebees, solitary bees. There should have been hundreds and hundreds of honeybees on that holly. And, you know, you could say, oh, well, perhaps there wasn't a hive nearby. But the solitary bees and the bumblebees, they should be living everywhere. And we're in Battersea Park, which has got the trees and the ground. So this is an indication of what our environment is doing to bees. We are losing so many bees. And at the flower show, there was quite a few people who were measuring insects and seeing how many were around. And there was a reasonable amount of people going, oh, I've seen five or six species of bees, and thinking that's really exciting. But we have 250 species of bees in Britain. Now, you wouldn't expect to find them all in London, but why not have 60 or 70 species of bees at an event where you've got all these gardens? Now, the sad thing about Chelsea is these gardens are put there. They're there for 10 days, you know, up to 3 weeks from the planning and the planting and the taking down again. And so that's very disruptive for all the native solitary bees and bumblebees that are living under the soil.
God, I'd never thought of that.
I know. It is quite terrifying.
But because also they force plants on and, you know, hold plants back. And so that the garden looks beautiful, but it's not the natural cycle. And I had never thought about what it would do to the natural pollinators.
Yeah, all the bees that live there. I mean, when you look at the site, before and after Chelsea Flower Show, it is just big lawns. Mm. And you would have in August, you'd have bumblebee queens will actually be mated, and they'll go under the turf and they will hibernate through the winter. And then in the spring, so from February, March onwards, they'll then be looking for old vole nests or old cavities in the ground, and then they'll start building their nests. So in May, you will have the bumblebees and the solitary bees at their peak laying season, you know, so there'll be all these little cavities in the ground where the bees will be nesting. So there are some people, Urquhart and Holt, who actually designed the Winning Garden for 2022, they're actually working on an installation of a bee hotel or bee home for all these species of bees. So that would be really exciting, that there will be a permanent habitat for these bees that will help ease the stress that something like Chelsea Flower Show would put on the environment.
God, you think of Chelsea as being some kind of, and I go as often as I possibly can and get tickets, or, you know, and I've noticed how wild the gardens have got for actually about 10 years. Mm. It's been quite a long time that the gardeners have been going, let's go back. You know, I remember when I first went back in 96, I think it was, and everything was very, very formal, and there were box hedges and, you know, kind of it was all very prim and proper. And then I remember that first year of going and all the wildness and the cornflowers and buttercups and, as you said, the nettles and the dandelions, and just going, oh my God, this is my idea of hell. It doesn't make me feel such a shit gardener anymore because it's what my garden looks like.
Well, and I think you have to look at what is Chelsea Flower Show trying to do, and we want to help people be more connected with their local environment. You know, and if you've got a garden and you can make it beautiful, then that's wonderful. And if you can make it beautiful for you, but also for the native pollinators, then that's wonderful. And I think the inspiration that so many people get from visiting Chelsea Flower Show, where you've got these innovative ideas, and although it's very controversial with some of the gardens, some of the top garden influencers are saying these are not gardens, it's a wild area. But actually, who's to say you can't have your back garden as a habitat for beavers or as a habitat for particular birds? You know, why does a garden have to be formal? It can be anything you want. It's your natural retreat. It's your place to go to heal, and nature heals. So the more natural we can have gardens, the better for everybody.
That's absolutely beautiful, and it's so true. And I actually think we almost have a duty now. Mm. Anybody that has a garden has a duty to help pollinators. I think we have got to a point that, you know, if we don't do something and we don't do something fast, we know we're heading for the sixth extinction.
You know, absolutely.
We can't do this. And everybody keeps going on about how it's our carbon footprint and driving a car. And you just have to look at the big corporations and you have to go, I'm sorry, why are the government allowing these emergency rulings? why are the farmers using it? You know, we spoke about sugar beet there. They must know in their heart of heart what these chemicals are doing, and yet they still use them. And they must have children, or, you know, why do they do it?
It's really difficult, because to be a commercial farmer, to earn a living, and anyone who's seen, you know, any of the great series about farmers, you get to realise that it's not a profitable industry. It's very, very difficult. And there's a lot of pressure on farmers on their yield. You know, they have to increase their yield. And a lot of farmers are influenced and advised by the agrochemical companies. You know, you'll have these experts who will tell you what you need to do to maximise your crop. And quite often it's a chemical response. It's saying, well, if you want to increase your yield, if you want to have healthy plants, you need to have this crop. So farming has got sort of simplified, but it is quite a complex issue, because if you look at the immunity of the plant, and if you look at how plants would grow naturally, you would not have a monoculture. You wouldn't have a big area with one type of plant. And the moment you put one type of plant all close together, if one plant gets sick, it is going to spread. You know, they're all going to get sick, whether it's a vibrational thing, whether it's terrain theory or, you know, germ theory, you know that they're all going to get sick. So instead of looking at why they're getting sick and looking at the quality of the soil and the, you know, farmers used to rotate with their crops, because they knew that different crops use different minerals and you could, you know, rebalance the soil in between.
But, and do companion growing.
Yes.
You know, my dad always did companion growing as well as rotation.
Absolutely. There's these kind of practices that have gone for thousands of years all around the world that work. But now it's like, okay, we've got this area, we want to maximise the crop, and we're always going to do this crop in this area. So the problem was that when the neonicotinoids first came out, they were tried on the rapeseed and sunflower seeds. And the beekeepers who took their bees to the sunflowers, particularly in Italy, Spain, France, they noticed a massive die out of their bees. So they would take their bees to these crops to get the honey, because sunflower honey is delicious. And that first exposure, millions and millions of bees died. And so the beekeepers said to the farmers, you know, what have you sprayed? Because we've lost all our bees. And the farmers were saying, well, we haven't sprayed anything. We don't need to spray anything because we've got this amazing new coating on our seeds. It then took 20 years of bee scientists to prove the connection between the neonicotinoids and the bee deaths. And the problem was that because not all of the bees died and not all of the insects died, the ones that survived adapted. And so each next exposure, you'd have less instant deaths. And we measure the safety of things on the instant death, not on the long-term consequences. So when you look at bees and their health over the last 20 years, there's lots more complex issues that are happening to bees that we weren't having before then. And so an exposure to these chemicals might not kill them outright, but it can have consequences on their fertility, it can have consequences on their behaviour, their communication, their navigation, and their nervous system, even their digestive system. So you can see the bees, you could take them to a field and say, oh, well, this field has neonicotinoids, but the bees haven't died, I've brought them back. But you might find that the queens are dying quicker, or that the colonies aren't growing as fast, or they're more susceptible to other disease. And then beekeepers are using chemicals in the hives to protect the bees from certain diseases. So again, you have this mixture of all these different chemicals coming in that are never tested. So when the neonicotinoids, after 20 years of use, they were finally banned because it was proven without doubt that they were damaging to bees, the farmers then had to think, well, what else do we do to protect our crops? And they've been trying to devise new safe, you know, and I'm using inverted commas for safe chemicals, to use on crops for farmers to be able to keep maintaining their yields. Now, there was always an argument that what farmers would do is be forced to use the older chemicals, which are more toxic for bees, instead of using these new synthetic ones. So there's been this argument that, well, the neonicotinoids, even though they kill bees and they're harmful, they're not as bad as the pyrethroids and the other chemicals that farmers used to use. So there's always been this argument. And it's unfortunately, we're a long way away from just saying, why don't we just stop using chemicals? You know, there's always going to be a consequence when you put something unnatural into an environment. So the situation now, and what the British government has agreed to do since we've left Europe, is they agree emergency use of the neonicotinoids on the crop called sugar beet. So some people say, well, sugar beet, that's fine because it's grown and it just feeds cattle. So we can use the neonicotinoids and it's not used for
that. But then the cattle are also eating the pesticides and we're getting that through dairy product or meat or, you know, it is a vicious circle.
Oh, it is. And the reason that the neonicotinoids on sugar beet is an issue for beekeepers is because the bees do pollinate it. They do forage on sugar beet. So they're going to be exposed to this chemical. But the ironic thing is the sugar beet grown in Britain isn't just for cattle feed, it's for our own sugar production. So humans are eating this sugar, but also lots of beekeepers feed their bees sugar and they're going to be buying British sugar to feed their bees. So even though you'll have beekeepers going, this is all wrong, we shouldn't be using neonicotinoids on our sugar beet, the beekeepers are buying the sugar that's been treated. So my argument has always been, well, if we don't like what's happening, we have to stop feeding it. We have to stop buying into it. So if the beekeepers stopped buying sugar, there wouldn't be such a big demand for sugar anyway in the UK. But I think humans as well have to think, OK, we've done all the tests on these chemicals on bees. Where are the tests on these chemicals on humans? When do
there
we test?
There aren't any that I know.
No,
of.
Exactly. I wonder why.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about with the bees and feeding them with sugar. I know this is something that you don't do, and you're a bit of a maverick, aren't you, love? And I've had this conversation with you before. It's so important that we don't feed our bees sugar. But as a child, if I saw a bee that was kind of poorly or couldn't fly or anything, I used to go and get sugar water because that's what I believed was the right thing to do. And we have this conversation on the last show and it's not the right thing to do. But just recap us why you shouldn't be feeding sugar to bees.
Okay. There are many levels to this. For me, because I was ill when I started keeping bees and I found that if I ate sugar, it increased inflammation, increased pain, and nausea, I knew that sugar wasn't very good. So I started looking into sugar for human health and realised that it actually was pretty bad and I shouldn't be eating it. And when my mentor first gave sugar fondant to my bees, I was horrified. I was like, what are you doing? And we had harvested all the honey. And he said, well, we have to feed them sugar because we've taken all the honey. They've got no food for the winter. So on one level, many people don't realise that the bees collect honey to feed themselves. And the reason honeybees are the only species out of the 22,000 species of bees in the world that make honey is because they're the only species that survive through the winter as a colony. And through the winter months, there isn't forage for them. There isn't nectar. They can't fly out. It's either too cold, too wet, or there's nothing in flower for them to forage from to get their nectar to make into honey. And all bees collect nectar for the carbohydrate and they collect pollen for the protein. But the honeybee has evolved to transform the nectar into a stable product, which is honey. So they add enzymes which help break down the complex sugars in the nectars, and then the honey is preserved. So honey is made up of about 180 compounds, and it has sucrose, fructose, and glucose. Now, commercial sugar is just sucrose. And it has a different carbon breakdown. So it's a carbon 6, I think. Forgive me if I've got this wrong, but honey is a carbon 3, so it's much easier to digest. Now, a sugar fondant matches the carbon level of honey. So this is an argument for using sugar fondant. But then you need to look at nutrition and why do bees collect nectar from different plants? Now, as through all my training as a honey sensory analyst, we're trained in Bologna to detect the floral source of a honey. So you can tell from tasting the honey that the bees have foraged on thyme or on sweet chestnut or lime tree.
And you were very generous to me on my 60th birthday and you gave me your rare dandelion honey, which is just unbelievably beautiful. And I just, every time I only have a tiny bit, I'm on rations because I know it's so rare. I think you only get about 6 jars a year. But, yeah, you know, you are a sommelier. You know how to taste and know exactly what honeys come from where. And I'm just going to ask you here, I presume with the bees, it's the same as us. We know we need, you know, 30 different plants, nuts, seeds, yeah, a week to get our gut biome going. And so the bees know that as well. They know that they have to forage from all the different plants, don't they?
Oh, they do. And it's been scientifically proven that bees will self-medicate. So you could have two hives next to each other in the same apiary, but they will forage from different nectar sources for their own hive. And when the scientists are evaluating the hive and what's, you know, what the chemical balance is of the bees, what the health is of the bees, they found the bees will select plants that have exactly the right compounds, the right mineral content that colony needs.
That's extraordinary. You told me a story earlier that I just want you to share because it absolutely blew my mind about a cow that basically committed suicide. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, yeah. Well, there's a wonderful chap called Peter Yeo who has done some lectures for the medical herbalist course that I'm still studying on with the IRCH. And he was sharing a story about a farmer in Devon who'd called him out because he was concerned about his cow had got sick. Now, I've known for a number of years, because I know some organic farmers, that they will let their cattle self-medicate as they walk to the milking parlour. So the cattle, as they're walking along, they'll go to different things in the hedges. So a good organic farmer will keep their hedges for a start, and they'll have a real mixture of different plants in there. So there'll be bramble, there'll be hawthorn, you know, blackthorn. There'll be all kinds of different things, and they'll have wild oregano, wild mints, you know, they'll all be around the edges of the fields. And they know that their cattle will self-medicate. Now, we also know that most animals will self-medicate. So a dog, if it needs to be sick, will eat grass because it will make it sick. And horses will not eat ragwort if they see it growing because they know it will make them ill. So cattle are the same. And Peter Yeo was telling me about how he's called out because this cow, walking to the parlour that it had done many, many times before, chose to eat something that it would have known was poisonous for it. So you'll get these odd weeds that come through the fences that the cows won't touch, but this cow touched it. Now, it poisoned itself to death. So the question is, why would a cow do that? You know, what level of misery was it in that it was committing suicide? And I think I've spoken with a lot of beekeepers as well and scientists who are studying bees, and there does seem to be more what appears to be suicide in the natural world, where you've got animals, you've got birds, you've got bees who are just dying for no apparent reason, but they could have prevented their own death. And I find this very, very interesting. You know, why it raises issues about death, about life, about purpose, about environment. Mm. And what do we learn from anything taking its own life, be it an animal or a fellow human? And we learn a lot, you know, with the increase of people, of young people committing suicide, you know, in the last few years. It's raising the issue of why are young people so unhappy? You know, what can we do to actually improve that? So if you think of the collective consciousness of nature, what is nature trying to teach us by animals, birds, bees, whatever it is in nature that you connect with, committing suicide? What is it trying to highlight to us that we need to change to stop this depth of misery? And yeah, this is what I find so interesting. And I think bees are almost the spokes beings for nature.
Oh yes, beings, spokes beings.
They are beings.
Yes.
And I love that the Buddhist monks in Bhutan, they believe the highest level of reincarnation is as a bee. And I love the fact that so many people are interested in bees and they don't know why. You know, people are buying mugs and tea towels with bees on, that you have cities where the bee is the logo. Bees are everywhere, but people know so little about bees, but we know we want to know more. You know, I'm always being asked, oh, I really want to save the bees, so should I get a beehive? Or I want to save a bee because it looks like it's dying, so shall I feed it sugar water? Or how can we help save the bees? People are wanting to know. And I feel this is nature communicating to humans. So our longing to learn more about bees is where our receiver, our natural radio receiver, is our intuition. And in our gut, in our intuition, we're feeling that the bees are trying to tell us something. And whether it's just by loving them on your tea towels, on your mugs, or loving them by keeping them, or loving them by planting for them, this is helping humanity. And this is what I love about bees, is I feel more and more beekeepers are listening to the bees, observing the bee behaviour and how much it's changed, and then thinking, well, what are they trying to tell us? What can we learn from listening to the bees? And that's what I love.
And there's a vibrational energy that by listening to the bees. I want to come back to the sugar, though. If you're not feeding them sugar water, how do you help them? How do you, when they're hungry, because you can't, you can give them their own honey, can't you? But you can't give them honey from another hive.
No.
Is that right?
Yes, because each hive has its own unique pathogens. And so you risk spreading disease if you're going to give bees honey. So you really shouldn't give bees honey unless it is their own honey.
So what do you do? If you're not giving them sugar water, what do you do?
Well, for a start, I always leave enough honey in the hive to let the bees feed themselves. And you have to be a bit more brutal, and you have to understand about the natural cycle of things. And in nature, not all swarms of bees will survive. You also have to think, why do bees not have enough honey? Britain used to be called the Honey Isles. It was where all the honeybees were. People used to travel all around the world to collect honey from Britain. We had a warmer climate and we had lots of bees and bountiful supplies of honey. Mead was made from honey. I mean, there was just so much, so many bees, so much honey. So what's changed? Well, we've cut down all the trees, which would have blossoms on. We've removed the hedgerows. We've removed the wildflower meadows. In Britain alone, we've lost 98% of our wildflower meadows just in the last 70 years. So the bees are hungry, not just because we're taking the honey, but because they're not even able to collect enough nectar to make enough honey to sustain themselves. So the priority has to be planting more things and keeping what we have got that flowers. So each colony of honeybees needs an acre of flowering plants, which you would get from a wildflower meadow. Now, an ancient tree could have the equivalent of 5 acres worth of plants.
Oh, my God. Do you know, that is so terrifying, because I read a statistic the other day. In Scotland, they've cut down, I can't think of the number now, 70 million trees or something?
Or was it like 170 million? It was just, it was one of those numbers that's so big you can't remember it, you know, because you can't attach it to
anything. It was huge. And they've cut these trees down to put green energy up, to put the...
Oh, the windmills.
The windmills. Yeah. And it's like, hang on, you've just cut down all these trees to put up the windmills that don't... you know, produce energy most of the time. And this is being done in the green climate name. Yeah. And you're killing off the bee population. I mean, what is wrong with these people?
I know, it is
Give
crazy.
Me that statistic one more time. So an acre of wildflower meadow is
what you need to sustain one colony of honeybees. But an ancient tree can have the equivalent of 5 acres of flowers. So if you have something like a lime tree, a linden or a lime tree, a 200-year-old lime tree will have 5 acres worth of flowers on. So they are so valuable. And the thing that really, really made a difference to me was hearing somebody say it takes 200 years to replace a 200-year-old tree.
Yes.
Because ivy takes 15 years before it flowers. Some trees won't flower for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. So at 200 years, most trees are at their prime. And if we cut them down then, it's no good cutting one ancient tree down and going, oh, it's fine, we've put 100 saplings in. It'll still take 200 years to replace the habitat that that one tree created. And this is what we really have to understand. And no trees in Britain are protected. we have to start getting out there and hugging our trees and protecting them, because we're losing a whole generation of mother trees, yeah. all the ancient trees that don't just carry all the blossom and the food and the habitat, but they carry the wisdom, the natural wisdom that needs to be passed down to their younger trees. And we're just wiping them out. Imagine if we did that to humans. Imagine if we just took out all the 80 to 100-year-olds.
Well, I think Matt Hancock did a pretty good job on that, love. But we won't go there. We'll talk about bees.
But yeah, and I think comparing bees with humans, if as humans we fed our children white sugar from August to April, which is what most beekeepers will do, how healthy would your children be?
It's so sad. It's so incredibly sad. And, you know, we've also seen lots of ancient forests come down to build train lines and
roads.
And there's, again, with the train lines, they're saying we're connecting the north to the south, and it means people don't have to drive in cars. And everything seems to be about the carbon footprint of the cars. While they're stopping farmers from, in Ireland, you know, they've really clamped down now that they can't produce dairy and meat, and there are strict regulations coming in on this. And we spoke about farmers earlier, and they get a bad rap. And we did talk about the near size and everything, and... You know, and I feel incredibly sorry for the farmers. And I just want to point out here, because I'm a huge supporter of organic farmers in the UK and all farmers. But, you know, obviously they need to kind of be re-educated, because, again, it is the educational system. But the people who are to blame here, fair and square, are the supermarkets, because the supermarkets don't pay what the farmers need for the food.
Now, I disagree. The people to blame, or who is to blame, is us, because we shop in the supermarkets. If we wanted to change the farming industry, we just stop buying chemically grown food and it would just change just like that. We have to take individual responsibility. And I know you and I, we do. We do. You know, and I mean, I have my name written all over my van. And so I have to walk the walk. I do not park outside. I do not shop in a supermarket. I've not shopped in a supermarket since 1992. And, you know, it's, I have reasons for not supporting those kind of industries. And with food, I eat organic, I support local farmers or chemical-free grown food, because I know that's making a difference.
You're very right. But at the end of the day, a lot of people will say, because of their time limits with work and everything else, they have to go to supermarkets. Now, you and I choose not to.
Yeah.
And I haven't shopped in a supermarket, done a proper food shop for many years either. But a lot of people will say it's very expensive to eat organically. But the cost, if we don't, is maybe the extinction of mankind.
Yeah.
And so you have to kind of look at, do you need that pair of trainers, or do you need, you know, whatever it is, that dinner out, which will be bought from a supermarket, or do you need to keep a world fit for purpose? And that's a decision that everybody has to make, and it's their decision, but they just need to know the facts, I think, in order
to make an informed decision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, and again, there hasn't been much of that going on in the last few years.
And I think it's that, but when you go through life and you are in okay health, you don't have to think about your food. You don't have to think about what chemicals you're putting on your body. When you lose your health, and for many people, if you lose your health, you've lost your work, you've lost your income, you've lost everything. You can lose relationships, families, all because of health. That's when you start to realise the importance of good food. And how many people, they might say, oh, well, I can't buy that bag of organic carrots or that tin of organic baked beans because it's three times the price of non-organic. But can you afford to not have a job, to not be able to work for 6 months?
Well, you have this from experience, because you weren't able to work for 7 years. In bed or in a wheelchair.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were able to heal yourself, and your journey very much started as mine did, with diet and nutrition.
Absolutely.
And it's really hard. I only spent 2 years of my life in bed, which seemed really hard, but compared to your 7 years, it's nothing. But, you know, this is what we've got to start looking at now. But I want to come back to bees, because We all know the importance of them. I would like to have a beehive, but I don't know where to start.
Okay, so I do, I often get asked about this. You know, I do talks, I was doing bee safaris at the Newt, honey tastings, I speak all over the place about bees. And the most common question is, oh, I really want to save the bees, so I want to get a beehive. Now, the first thing I say to people is, why do you want bees? Are you wanting bees because you think that having bees will help save them? In which case, that's not the reason to keep bees. Keeping bees is the biggest risk to bees. There's a professor, Peter Neumann from Germany, who says the biggest risk to bees is beekeepers. And it's because of the practice of beekeeping is not very sustainable. It's not very good for bees. There's a lot of practices that really have to change. And the science supports it. What I love about speaking at scientific conventions is I have these scientists going, thank you for saying what we're showing, but we can't get the beekeepers to listen. So if you want to keep bees because you feel you have this connection, which I had, you know, I just felt it was something I just felt called to do whilst I was bedbound. I thought, what can I do? I can no longer paint. I can no longer have my business. I can't walk anywhere. But I could lay in bed and watch bees. So I begged my husband to build me. He built me a beehive so I could lay in bed and watch the bees. And a local beekeeper taught me beekeeping. And as he taught me beekeeping, I realised that beekeeping was not nearly as natural as I had assumed. I think we all have this vision of a beekeeper, of this lovely old chap with a long white flowing beard, you know, a bit like Father Christmas in the back garden, tinkering with the bees. The bees love him. He loves the bees. And every now and again, he has a bit of honey. Unfortunately, it's not like that. The irony is people go, oh, yeah, well, then the honey producers or the big bee farmers, they're exploiting the bees. Well, quite often, because of finances, the big honey producers are more natural because they don't have the income to pay for the chemicals or the sugar. So they want to have bees that will look after themselves, that will be healthy and are good for their environment. So the big trouble is the individuals, the hobby beekeepers who might have one or three hives, who are putting chemicals inside the hive to protect against disease or treat diseases. They're over manipulating the bees. They could be culling the queens and replacing them with imported queens. They can be feeding them sugar. There's just moving them around too much. You know, there's so many things that beekeepers do. And when you decide that you want to keep bees, you become responsible for livestock. You know, how many people would get a dog or a horse or even a, you know, a load of sheep without doing a bit of research on how you take care of them? And unfortunately, bees seem to be the kind of pets that you could have without knowing what you're doing. But the moment you put bees from the wild into a hive, you are responsible for them. And you're putting them in an environment which is not natural. And particularly most of the beehives that you see available are no good for bees. There's amazing new citizen research that's come out. There's a chap who's been studying the insulation of hives. There's been many studies on the insulation of beehives. And what we know is that when bees live in a natural environment, which would be a cavity in a tree, so a cavity made by squirrels or woodpeckers, and the bees will nest in there, the tree bark and the inside of the tree could be 10 centimetres thick. So that gives really good insulation for the bees so that they're able to maintain their core temperature throughout the year. It takes a long time for the coldness outside to get inside a tree cavity. Now, what this chap has found out, Derek Mitchell, is that when you have a conventional beehive, it's only about 3 centimetres thick of wood and the bees go into torpor. Now, we're all taught that that's what bees do in the winter. They all huddle up together. They take turns to go on the outside to keep the core of them warm. And that's normal. That's what we're expecting our bees to do. But now the research is showing that this is actually a stress response, because if they were in a well-insulated hive, they don't need to go into this tight cluster just to survive.
Sorry to interrupt this podcast. The Wellness Way has got a brand new interactive ebook out. I've created a beginner's guide to your natural health systems to help you navigate through the jungle of natural health. A banquet of knowledge wrapped up in a simple ebook, featuring some of my top guests from the podcast, As an added bonus, I've even thrown in my meditation album, The Wellness Awakening, From Past Lives to Passing. Head over to my webpage, phillyjlay.com, to grab your copy now. And while you're there, why don't you sign up for my newsletter? And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share this podcast so we can continue to get this information out. Remember, the doctor of your future is you.
That's really interesting, because obviously a tree trunk is going to give them a lot more insulation. And the tree also, because trees are so clever, we have all the mycelium under the ground talking and protecting all the trees. And presumably that energy is coming up and also giving life force energy to the bees.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And the bees in a tree environment, they're higher up, they're protected from predators. But also they can collect the resin from the trees to make their propolis, and they will do a sort of skin lining inside the cavity. And the propolis is antibacterial, antiviral, antiseptic, antibiotic. It is basically their skin. Now, beekeepers have been breeding bees not to produce propolis because it sticks the hive together and makes honey extraction really difficult.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So bees are being bred to be gentle and calm so they can't defend themselves, to not produce propolis so they're without a skin, and then being fed sugar so they're not having a good balanced nutrition, and then they're being treated chemicals. Now, if we just translated any part of that to human breeding, we'd be horrified, wouldn't we?
Well, you're being caught.
yeah.
And it begs the question, why aren't people in court for this at the moment?
It's... because not everyone believes that bees are sentient beings.
Okay. Well, so... I do want to come on to the great scandal of Australia at the moment, where last year I was posting an awful lot about this young man who was a beekeeper who was in absolute tears online the whole time. Mm. Can you tell us what's been going on there and what's happening in Australia with the bees at the moment, the virus? And
okay, so it's varroa mite. Now, the whole world has had varroa mite for about 30-odd years, apart from Australia. So Australia was this one continent where there wasn't varroa mite. And the varroa mite is a parasite which breeds inside the larvae cells of honeybees. And it had been transferred from Apis cerana, which is the Asian honeybee, and then it got transferred to Apis mellifera, which is the Western honeybee. And humans have been transporting Apis mellifera all around the world for hundreds of years, because if we colonized somewhere and we wanted to grow fruit and veg, we'd take our bees so they could pollinate it. Completely unaware of all the native and natural pollinators in any environment. So, you know, hundreds of years of damaging transportation of pollination for a start, as pollinators, has been difficult. Now, about 30 years ago, the varroa mite transferred from Apis cerana to Apis mellifera. And in the UK and Europe, the first year that this happened, beekeeping went from being Father Christmas in his back garden tinkering with the bees to suddenly being quite a terrifying and upsetting practice, because bees just died. The varroa mite came into the hives and it just wiped the colonies out, because Apis mellifera had not adapted to cope with this pest. And where the pest breeds as the bees are developing, it feeds on the they used to think it was on the hemolymph, but now we know it's the fat bodies of the bees. And so the bees emerge and they're very weak, and they then are vulnerable to other diseases. So the bees will not form their wings properly. They will get all kinds of other viruses and things because they've been attacked by the varroa mite. And so there's been lots of different things to count and measure your varroa mite in your hive, but also to prevent and treat the varroa mite. So a year into having varroa mite, chemicals suddenly came out. And of course, they drench the hives with chemicals, and they change the manufacture of hives to have a mesh at the bottom. So when you put the chemicals into the top of the hive, the varroa mites drop through. So these chemicals have been devised to kill an insect that lives on an insect. So you're going to have some collateral damage. So people do lose their honeybees as well. But it was always thought, well, we're not losing all of them, so the bees will recover. So it's now recommended that you treat your bees with chemicals between 2 and 3 times a year. Some of the early chemicals have since been banned because they are so toxic and bad for bees as well as the vermite. But also the vermite adapts. So Joe Bleasdale, one of my bee team who helped me with my bees and a wonderful mentor, he always says, if you treat with a chemical treatment and one vermite survives, you've now reared a treatment-resistant vermite. And that's what's been happening. So Tom Seeley, Professor Tom Seeley, who's a bee scientist in New York State, he's been studying bees since the 1970s. And as well as studying them in laboratory and apiary conditions, he also has been studying wild colonies in a very isolated forest in New York, upstate New York. And he's been collecting samples of the bees for 50 odd years. And what he has now proven about 4 or 5 years ago is that the bees in the wild have adapted to protect themselves against varroa. And in the UK, there is a belief that the native Apis mellifera, which is the black bee, that were untouched by chemicals, they have also adapted and survive. But this is a very controversial belief, because if it's true, I believe it's true and I can see it is true, but that truth means that bees didn't need chemical treatments. And this is obviously upsetting for people who've been using chemical treatments in the belief that that was the only way to save their bees. And it's also very upsetting for those that earn a living from selling the chemicals, because suddenly...
They've just lost their job.
Now, what happened in Australia was, because they didn't have varroa, they didn't use chemical treatments inside their hives, so their beeswax had a premium price. If you want to use beeswax in cosmetics, you don't want to have traces of bee chemicals in there. So Australia had a premium beeswax price. They didn't have varroa, so it was all lovely. Then in August 2022, the government had 3 sentinel beehives in Newcastle Port in New South Wales, and 2 of the hives were found to have vermite in. So the government destroyed those 2 hives and then instantly put a 10-kilometre exclusion zone around that area, where they decided to cull all the bees. So they started off culling all the beehives, the farmed bees and managed bees. And the idea for that was to have this sort of like a ring of fire, so the varroa couldn't go anywhere. Now, August is just coming up to early spring in Australia. And in early spring, they have the almonds flowering. And Australia in New South Wales is the second biggest monoculture of almond growing. And just like in California, where to pollinate the almonds, they have to transport millions and millions of honeybees to pollinate the almonds, because the monoculture has destroyed the habitat and the actual mason bees that would be more effective at pollinating it. And you don't get honey from mason bees, they're just little solitary bees that pollinate almonds. And we have, in the UK, we have the red mason bee that pollinates apples. So they're really important bees. But because we don't take honey from them, people just don't know about them. So what was happening was, you suddenly have this varroa, you have a 10-kilometre exclusion zone where they kill the bees, but they're coming up to the fact that somebody needs to move bees to these almonds to pollinate them. So the government made a decision that nobody could move their bees unless you were a big bee farmer whose business was pollinating the almonds. Now, if you have a contagious parasite, you would not put lots of different bees from all different areas in together so the parasite could transfer. But that's exactly what they did. So they, by allowing bees to be transported to pollinate the almonds, you suddenly then, the spread of vermite just went all over. So I think currently there's like 180 kilometre exclusion zone. And what the administrators of that area did, they started off by culling bees. Then they started culling the wild bees in the trees. So if children were in the forest and they saw wild honeybees, they could get a reward for notifying that that's where the wild bees were. And then they'd be culled. Oh, and lots of beekeepers, small and large, would have, vets would come out and they would write off their bees. So they'd pour petrol into the hives and set light to them and burn the bees so that everything was destroyed. Now, at Appomondia, which is a global bee conference, I was talking to Jodie Goldsworthy, who was the head of, it's called Australasia, or Oceania is the region that includes Australia for beekeepers, world beekeepers. She was not consulted by the government about how they could act with Varroa. Now, we now know around the world that you've got chemical-resistant Varroa mites, you've got wild bees that have adapted to Varroa. So if they use the collective wisdom of beekeepers and bee scientists around the world, yes, you would have a bit of an exclusion zone, but you'd know you don't need to kill the bees. What you could do is have stop all movement of bees, monitor bees, and allow death of the bees that are overtaken by the Varroa, but
and
allow the ones to survive.
And that would be a natural death, won't it?
It would be. You are going to lose a lot of bees, just like we did in Britain. But then the bees that survive would be resistant, and you would have a few years of a dramatic decrease of bees, but then they would build themselves up, they'd be stronger, and Varroa would never, no longer be a problem, and beekeepers wouldn't need to use chemical treatments.
It's devastating for me to listen to this, and you know, we've heard about Varroa, we know about the pesticides, and I'm going to come back to if you want to have bees in your garden. So we've heard every reason that you shouldn't, you know.
Yeah.
And they will be naturally in the trees and everything. So what if you still feel this urge that you want a beehive?
Okay. So I think that urge is you want to save the bees. You really want to do something good for the bees. You want to connect with the bees. So the bees need more homes. Because the bees swarm, they naturally live in hollows of trees, but we're cutting down all the trees. So we don't have those middle-aged trees with the hollows in. So when a bee expands, it's natural, it will swarm. That's the babies, you know, that is the how the colonies expand. So by providing habitat for bees, then you're helping. So if you really want to have bees, but you're still on a learning and you're still wanting to understand what you need to know, so before you can go on a course or before you've done a course, what you can do is have a log hive that you hang up on a tree. You hang it up about 3 or 4 metres high, and that's providing a home for passing bees. It'll be above head height. They're not going to be swarming all around your barbecue or your patio, but you can also connect with them because you can stand underneath the tree, you can watch the bees, and you can learn their life cycle by providing that habitat. So that's something I would recommend, but you really should do a course. Not just because I do courses, but you can do free courses with the BBKA or very minimal costs. But the BBKA courses will instruct you the conventional beekeeping. So it will all be about how much honey you can take, when you take the honey, and when you put chemical treatments on, and breeding queens. So it can be off-putting for many people to do that course because they're like, I don't want to keep bees in that way. But I still think it's important to know what you don't want to do because you are responsible for your bees. Then if you get a hive, look at a hive that has really good insulation. So there's hives called zest hives, which use aerated concrete blocks, very, very cheap to put together. They do have plastic frames, which I know again is very controversial. I'm a natural beekeeper, of course I like wood, but I prefer trees to having them cut down to make beehives. So I've started using plastic beehives, but I'm using a plastic frame, but the bees still produce their own wild natural comb, and that is really important. So for anyone who's listening who understands a bit about beekeeping, I don't use foundation. You can actually buy pre-printed wax that the bees will draw out.
Okay, you've lost me there because I don't know. So no, tell me a bit more about this because this is fascinating.
Yeah, so if you are going to have bees, so if you go to your conventional beekeeping group, and it's good to be in a group because you'll meet other beekeepers and you will learn things, but just be mindful that you will be taught things and you'll be surrounded by people who do things that perhaps you don't want
to
do.
Absolutely, and for that reason, I would say to anybody, if you have a chance to do Paula's courses and learn to do it the proper way, just go for it, you know, do it before you have your bees. Run me through the So the plastic frames, and they still have to build.
Yes, so bees, the other reason they collect nectar to turn into honey is they need honey to make beeswax. Beeswax is made from honey. And bees need 8 kilos of honey to make 1 kilo of wax. And your average bee hive will need between 1.5 and 2.5 kilos of wax. So bees need a lot of honey anyway. Now, bees, they would live in a cavity in a tree, absolutely fine without frames. You could have a woven straw skep, which is something I also make, which is really good insulation for bees. And, you know, if you want to learn how to make a straw skep, go on a workshop. It's a red-listed traditional craft. It's a really important thing to do. And the bees will swarm in there and they'll just attach their own wax comb to the inside of the hive. Now, that is not practiced so often now because you cannot remove the wax very easily. You either have to cut it out. What used to happen is the bees would be either smoked out in sulfur pits or they'd be drowned. So then you'd have the basket full of honey. So hives were devised for humans. So you have removable frames and it would be a wooden frame and the bees would make wax within that frame. And then you could lift the wooden frame out to inspect for disease, to you know, to manage your bees and also to take honey. So there is an argument that if you have plastic frames, and there's a beehive called the Flow Hive, which has been very popular, which is an Australian designed hive designed by two really lovely beekeepers, but it does have very thin wood. And that has plastic frames that are completely plastic. So the honeycomb has been made out of plastic. And the idea of those is the bees fill up the honeycomb with honey, and then you have a tap that you can turn at the back of the hive and the honey drains out. So it's a non-interventional way of taking honey without having to open up the hive and have the bees flying everywhere. So that's another
And that must be a stress for them. And I suppose in life you've got to weigh up. For me, it's pretty horrific to hear plastic beehive.
Yeah.
But I know you're just, if not more so natural than I am.
Yeah.
But you think this is better than, you know, cutting down native trees that they need. Yeah. And also, it's stressful for them, isn't it, when you open it up and...
It is.
It's massive stress, and that's why they go ballistic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you need to be... When you're working with bees and you become very present and you can be on the same frequency as the bees, 256 hertz, so that is being present, being calm, then you can work with the bees. And if the bees know, and if you know what you're doing, you can work together with them. You can prevent them from swarming by giving them more space, by just understanding the life cycle of bees. So there's a lot of management that you can do that is still quite natural. And then there's a lot of management you can do that is not natural, that is very much for the human benefit. Now, I was not pro plastic beehives at all until I met during a honey competition, a fellow judge from Turkey, Emre, who is one of the kindest, gentlest men on the planet. And his father has a beekeeping hive manufacturing company that they've had for 50 odd years in Turkey. And they found that some rules changed in China where a certain region in China banned cutting down trees for non-essential building. And there are many countries in the world now that, you know, Japan, you can't cut down trees, Bhutan, you know, don't cut down trees. And so, but the beekeepers still needed hives. So Emre and his father devised these plastic beehives that are made from food grade plastic, a sustainable forever plastic. So the problem we have is these one single use plastics because there's no such place as a way to throw them.
No,
you know, everything comes back. Whereas a beehive, you want it to last forever. And because the inside is inside and it's protected with the bees, you don't have any kind of single use. So by having frames inside a hive and by having a hive that's sort of a modular build that's very thick, it gives really good insulation. Now, I experienced these to my real shock where I was completely converted was in 2020. I visited a remote desert island, which is actually in Australian territory called Cocos Keeling. And you know, I have interesting stories about why I even went there, but they have bees there.
You dreamt about this island when you were young.
Yeah, in my early 20s, I just had this random dream about this island. And then it took, you know, years before a whole string of coincidences ended up with me being photographed by a chap who was born on the island, and his brother still lives there and keeps bees. So then my husband and I, Greg and I, we decided, well, we have to go and visit just to quench this thirst I'd had about, and you, why did I dream about the island?
And you got there just before that first lockdown. You left the island.
We were the last flight northbound off Christmas Island, which is the neighbouring island, and we'd done the north route through Jakarta, whereas now you can only get to Cocos Island flying from Perth in Australia. So, yeah, we were there just when it was all kicking off. And I met the beekeeper, so Johnny and his son, Jack. And they had the flow hives from Australia, which are thin wooden hives. And we used the taps and we took some honey. But they also had these Api May hives that come from Turkey. And I was astonished because I'd only heard about them from Emre. I'd never seen them anywhere else. And suddenly on this remote desert island, they have these Api May hives. And I'm like, wow, how did you get these? Can't remember how they got there because they've been there for years. And they are perfect in the tropics because you're on a remote desert island with lots of coconut trees and the bees need hives, but wood rots because of the humid conditions. And it is very hot and humid. It's like 26 to 30 degrees all year round. So the bees still struggle to keep cool. So they want to actually nest wild in the trees, but not even in a hive at all. So if you want to have honey, you want to try and get them back into a hive. And these plastic hives are brilliant. And the bees can propolise them. They can coat the inside of propolis. They make their own wild comb. And you've got the frames, which mean you can lift the comb out and you can take the honey. So that was a complete game changer for me, where I realised that plastic does have a place. We do have it, but we need to make sure it's a quality plastic. Now, the next best thing is like, oh, of course, it should be recycled plastic. Well, actually, the recycling of plastic can have consequences, and not all plastics should be recycled. And if you want to provide a good, healthy home for the bees, because the temperature of the hive is always 35 degrees, you need to have, or 35 to 37, you don't want a plastic in there that is going to release toxic fumes at certain temperatures. So these hives are food grade manufactured plastic to last, you know, that's it. So it was so interesting how me, that was all into, you know, having log hives and wooden hives. And I think as well, when you go and visit, I love the Arboretum, the near Tetbury and Westonbert.
Yes. Yeah,
and I remember seeing these great Western red cedars, and that's the gold standard of beehives, is a Western red cedar. And standing at the base of one of these beautiful giant trees and looking at it and thinking, how many beehives would you get from that? And how tragic, because how many hundreds of years has that tree been there? And, you know, a good Western red cedar beehive could last you for, 70, 80 years. You know, it is a good wood. It is a good strong wood. You know, but we do need to think of alternatives, because we don't want to cut down all the Western red cedars. You know, they're slow growing. They take a long time to grow, which is why they're so good for beehives, because they grow slowly. You know, the rings are close together, so it makes it a really good strong solid wood. So there's lots of complex issues with beekeeping and bees that are not straightforward. And when we connect with bees, we're connecting with nature, and we need to find our happy place, our role, our mission within them. Is it watching them, you know, from high up in a tree? Is it protecting the wild colonies in the woodlands near you that you found, that you don't want someone to cut those trees down where the bees will lose their home? Is it planting pollinator corridors between your gardens, you know, around your village, around your town, along roadsides, so that we have more food for all the pollinators and the bees that are around? Is it by lobbying to stop treating soil, you know, stop treating grass or farmland, so that the other pollinators have a home? So it's thinking about, when you love bees and you want to save the bees, which bees you're trying to save. And then understanding death. So when you see a bee and you think, oh, it's not doing anything, I need to feed it some sugar water. So quite often it would be a big fat fluffy bumblebee,
yep,
that you see on the tarmac or on a footpath near some flowers, and it's like, oh, it's not moving, I need to feed it some sugar water. Now that's a human perspective looking at a bee. I had somebody once, very well-intentioned, they saw a bumblebee, and it was, they were at a garden somewhere, and they saw this bee, and they thought, it's starving, but I haven't got any sugar water with me. She picked it up, put it in her handbag, drove it 10 miles home, gave it some sugar syrup and then put it in the garden, and then thought to message me to say, have I done the right thing? And because it felt that's what I needed to do. So first of all, the bumblebee could have been dying. Bees don't live forever, and they don't die inside their nest because that's more effort and work for their fellow bees. So they will just stop dying. You know, they'll just stop somewhere and die. So if you see a bee on a footpath, then watch it for a bit, because also it could just be resting. It takes a lot of energy for them to take off and fly.
Yeah.
So they just need a bit of a pause. So you could just pick it up and put it on a flower or put it off so it's not going to be trodden on. That would be the first thing to do. If you have got a drop of water, you can give it a drop of water and it might drink some water and that will help perk it up. But don't give it sugar. Now, I liken her story to if I was sat meditating in the garden, say at the Newt, you know, where it's a public or, you know, member's garden, and I'm sat there and people saw me doing nothing, thinking, oh my gosh, Paula's not doing anything. Is she dead? Is she dying? I need to force feed her with something. Well, sugar, we know, is highly addictive. So it would be like somebody giving me cocaine, then putting me in a vehicle, driving me to Newcastle. I live in Somerset. And then putting me out in Newcastle and thinking, right, we've given her the cocaine. We've put her back out in nature. So now she'll be fine. I would really struggle. I mean, having never done any kind of drugs.
Such a good analogy.
But yeah, how would I get back from Newcastle?
Yeah.
And you see, bumblebees, they only travel in about a mile radius from their home. So the moment you move them outside of that, they're completely disorientated. They've lost their family. They've lost, they don't know where all the plants are that they feed from. You know, a bee needs to be in its environment and it can hear the song of all the different plants. So it knows where the nutrition is, it knows where it needs to go next, and it knows where its nest is. Unless our environment is disturbing its communication pathways, which is what neurotoxins in neonicotinoids do.
Well, I think on that note, we've covered an awful lot on bees. There's a huge amount to take in. Now, I know you've got some very exciting things happening in your life over the next year.
Yeah.
And I really want you back on the show so we can talk about them. We can't talk about them now. But just, you know, the work that you're doing for Be Kind.
Yeah.
Oh, start a campaign, Be Kind.
Yes, yeah. Well, I have a Kinder Keeping beekeeping course.
You do?
So, yes, which is really funny because I had a banner. I was demonstrating skep making in Devon last summer and I had this banner that was like, you know, Kinder Keeping. And almost everyone who read it said, Kinder Keeping, what's Kinder Keeping? And I thought, how extraordinary that you can have a word. I mean, obviously in Britain, you know, with the British language, you have words that can be read so many different ways. But it's like, why do people first of all think kinder, I mean, like kinder eggs, rather than kinder? Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting. That's been a fascinating conversation. There's so much to unwrap here and to think about. And I would just like to say as a takeaway, you know, as Paula said earlier, every single one of us can do our part. And that starts with the power of your money. And you're absolutely right, Paula. So, you know, if you don't have the money, and most people don't, it's really hard. You know, I make the choice over organic food over a lot of other things. You know, I went 5 years without a holiday, but my organic food is, you know, what I have to do for me to be healthy. But you can just go to a farmer's market, get to know your farmers and ask them when they're spraying, because there are lots of farmers that can't get the organic certification. It's very expensive, isn't it?
It is.
They don't want to use chemicals, but occasionally they have to. But they're really honest. Talk to them, have a conversation and go, you know, what have you sprayed this month? And also say, what do you think you might have to spray coming up? That's a really good one. And if they say, we're looking at, you know, some problems with this crop, we might have to spray it in a week, we're holding out for a bit, then stock up on it. Eat that for a couple of weeks. Get it in your freezer. Can it? You know, do whatever you can. But that is the way to do it. And also by eating seasonal, you are helping those farmers in their quest to bring seasonal food to the world. And just one last thing before we go. I have to ask you about the fact that bees have died out before. And so if this happens and there is a possibility, tell us what comes back.
Well, I was finding it very interesting that lots of people tell me when they've seen dead bees or that the bees are just not around, you know, where they've got flowering plants and there used to be lots of bees and now there aren't bees. And yet I'm finding wherever I work, I'm seeing more and more bees. So there is always that argument that the more you look, the more you see. However, there's no dispute. There are a lot of bees that are dying. And then I did a bee safari and I had a lady on there who asked me, she said, is it true that there have been times in history where bees have vanished? And I didn't know this, but to me, that was the missing factor to a belief I have. So her son was taught at school that when they look through all the Jurassic periods and, you know, where you've got fossils right through the ages, that there are periods of time where there are no bee fossils and it appeared the bees had completely vanished and yet they'd come back again. Now, this doesn't make any sense. How could a species die out and then reappear? And this is where I think frequency and vibration and energy and heavens and earth are all wonderfully connected. So the Buddhist monks in Bhutan believe the highest level of reincarnation is as a bee. We know that bees have a higher frequency. So how about if we have this reality, this three-dimensional reality of one vibration, which at the moment is a very human vibration, which is like 70 to 90 hertz. And then you have higher vibration places, you know, a fifth dimension, say, where it could be 200 or 300 hertz that it's frequenting at. Could it be that the bees are from that vibration, that frequency, that special place, that heaven, and they come back to our place, our earth, to teach us what we need to know to get to heaven? And so when the bees die, I do believe they're sentient beings. I do believe they have a soul. And I do believe that they're very spiritual. So when a bee dies, I don't think it's the end. I think they go to this higher vibration, fifth dimensional place. And that's what I love. And I think that would explain how they can come and go. And so if you're seeing bees dying, I think that's a message from the heavens, from the heavenly beings, that something is out of balance. And that's what we need to learn from, is asking, why are they dying? And if they're dying and we share the same environment as them, what's killing us?
Yeah. When will it happen to us?
Yeah.
Paula, that has just been the most wonderful conversation. I could talk to you and listen to you forever and a day. And please come back on the show soon. But until then, thank you very much for being here. What a lovely conversation. Have a great week, everyone. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you.